probably 20 miles of dirt road to get to it.
13 people have died here, I think.
13?
Yeah. I'll show you a blood stain on the floor.
Just so naive. I mean, they didn't know that the president was black. Like, is he black?
She was born and raised on CNET, you know. She had no idea that people would live out in the country.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. We have so much coming up, including a few bonus listener story episodes from you guys. So if you haven't sent yours in, please do. To sevendeadlysinnerspodcast@gmail.com. We're going to try to do one a month of those, so we're compiling some amazing stories from you guys, which means you get extra content, which at least for me, when I'm listening to podcasts, which is all I do besides research and write a podcast, I'm super grateful when a podcast I love and listen to in the community, not that I'm saying you are like in love with me, but let's listen, just let me build myself up because I'm about ready to sound creepy. Anyways, I'm just always so grateful when there's extra content for a show I love. And listen, I can't get enough of you guys, so I'm hoping you can't get enough of me. And this really is going to be more about you. So please send your stories in. And I'm really second guessing myself. Like, why am I always a little creepy? When I'm essentially just trying to say, hey, I love you. You're cool. Let's be friends. I'm old enough now that I'm probably not going to all of a sudden develop a chill, detached personality. So I'm glad you all are my people. You've stuck with me. Okay, enough of the business. This is going to be an anger-inducing, head-scratching, a story with unlimited questions with maybe no answers on the why and how episode on a cult. But it's also probably going to be two episodes, and I'll tell you why right now. I can't figure out if this dude is still at it or not, if he's dead or alive. And in order to do so, I need to drive the hour and a half or so back to the town where his cult is located, because on my trip last week there, I had assumed he was dead, just based on the fact that he was older, and there's a YouTube video where he says the Messiah's last words, but I could not find a definitive answer that he was dead. But I was like, he's got to be dead. He can't still be at it, right? So I just sort of glossed over that. I was like, I'll figure it out after I leave the town, which was a mistake, because after finishing this episode, that question is still up in the air. So my promise to you is that this week I'll be going there. And based on the fact that I'm 80% sure he is still at it, I'm probably going to break this into two parts. Because once you hear of his crimes, you'd be shocked to find out he still has followers. So I'm going to go back to find out in person with a chaperone. Don't worry. I'm not going to do anything crazy. To see for myself, try to speak to members if possible. And if I'm lucky, in the worst way possible, because I really don't want to stand face to face with him, I could actually get some sort of interview from the scumbag Messiah of Strong City. But regardless if it becomes two parts and if I get to speak to him, this case will lead us into the beginning of spooky season, where we will be covering for the month of October, I'm really excited about this, haunted sins. And we have some crazy stories for you. Bone-chilling tales. Lore that will make you think, like, wow, what if that is true? Ghostly tales of greedy gold rush miners. Outlaws in a certain haunted, abandoned New Mexico hotel where we stayed last week for kind of a combo pack research trip that involves this cult, but then also for spooky season, the weird way they connect and beyond. I know that was a lot, but it will all make sense. So gang, you are in for some crazy shit coming up. Today's cult, not so lighthearted. Like I said, more anger-inducing. But the month of October is mostly stories that you tell around the campfire. but ones that have been also kind of largely proven, maybe even just by sheer numbers of people to have encountered these things, even myself. Oh yeah, I've had some spooky stories. And a lot of these are going to be spooky stories that happened decades ago that will still make you mad in certain cases, but in others will just make you turn your light on a little brighter next month when you go to sleep. Just that little nightlight, like, maybe I don't want it to be pitch black. So stay tuned for the trailer for our spooky season series this week. But for now, thank you for listening. And buckle up for a guy. I may travel back to New Mexico. I am going back twice in a week to find out that I can control myself from punching him. I will control myself, but I might just laugh in his face a little bit. A cold case that for whatever reason, but I think it's just that there's not a lot of pomp and circumstance. There's, and not that that justifies anything, but it's not, I just can't wrap my head around how people fell for him. But I always want to put myself in other people's shoes. And this has always been a seven deadly sinners motto. I truly believe this. And I'm not going to discount myself from falling for this guy. I haven't been around him. Maybe he's magical. Maybe I'm into him and I'm like, oh God, yeah, he is the Messiah. But like I've said before, and I've said again, and I hope you guys agree with me, there's not one of us that is immune to falling for a coercive partner, a cult leader. You know, sometimes they meet you at the right time, the right place in your life, and fill a niche that you were so desperate to just fill that void yourself that, yeah, all right, what a coincidence that this person came along at this time. Because we're all humans and we're all grieving at certain points, lonely, seeking, impressionable, and mostly hopeful. I think that's the thing that makes us feel whole. Like, this will be the thing that gives us purpose. Like, oh my God, it's this easy. This person came along and it makes us feel important and unique. And finally, they kind of always make it like these cult leaders or, you know, like a coercive partner or something. They kind of make you feel like, oh my God, this is the magic sauce solution, the end of the road where no more suffering occurs and everything makes sense. And happiness is as easy as opening your eyes every morning once this person's in your life. And listen, I think many of us are happy and many of us aren't. And many of us have bad days and good days and bad moments and good moments. But I gotta tell you, and take this with a grain of salt, because I am no mental health professional, please go easy on yourself. And just know, I don't think there is no end of the road suffering or end of stress or pain forever. Those moments are mixed in with the most joyful and proud and accomplished and loving moments of your life. So if we can learn anything from cults, is that there is no quick fix. There is no random 66-year-old creep who claims, amongst many other things, that he is the Messiah and the Chosen. Steer clear of those con artists and just be confident that you are strong enough to handle the ups and the downs of life and that they pass. Okay, I'm done now with my major tangent. I just love you guys, and if you're struggling, I hope of what any shred of what I said helped, and I hope you avoid the strong city cult of Folsom or Clayton, New Mexico. It's kind of in the middle. Folsom, very cool. Historical as shit. But the cult, not so cool. You turn down a long dirt road. And if invited by a man named Michael, you may not leave. Now, before we meet the man behind the crime, let's discuss what it means to be so sinfully gluttonous in your personal needs and desires that, spoiler alert, you find a way to justify sleeping with your own son's wife. All in the name of God. Wayne Bent, the subject of our case, who we will meet momentarily, could have been accused of pride, 1,000%, of lust, 2,000%. But for me, gluttony fits the most because it is a sexual, selfish gluttony at the expense of others. Gluttony is also known to be the twin of lust. Lust is an intensive sexual desire or appetite, a passion, a desire or craving so strong it doesn't even need to apply to sex. It's just an uncontrolled, excessive desire. This is all according to religion, but it makes sense to me, even if I hate to ascribe anything to one religion or whatever, because this is sort of, this podcast is not about boosting this stuff, but it makes sense. And again, it's not that I'm not religious. I believe in God. You guys know that. I just don't like bad people. All right, moving on. But this all seems logical. And then it seems logical to me that religion states that gluttony is a twin to lust. It is the mad pursuit of the bodily pleasure that is never completely satisfied. You know, we usually connect gluttony with food, but it can also be drinking and even work, soap operas, exercise, video games, you name it. It's excess. And often, and especially in Wayne Bent's case, often at the expense of others. And a person like Wayne Bent is so self-indulgent in his desires that he's only primed to find a way to exploit others to chase the dragon of fulfilling these desires at the cost of everyone around them. And the perfect place to do that? Well, a cult. But not just a cult. A cult off the grid. Enter our scene, a town of 40 to 50 people in Folsom, New Mexico, with the next metropolis being maybe 2,500 people in Clayton, New Mexico, lies a cult tucked somewhere in between along a long dirt road.
Pick up, and I'm going 80 miles an hour down these caliche roads. My nearest neighbor's 8 miles away. It's 18 miles down the road where I live. And she's like, "You live out here?" And I was like, "Yeah." And then I guess Samuel, one of the boys, said, "I was born in a bathtub, or I was born in a stock tank," I guess is what he was like. They're like, "Yeah, yeah." Whenever he says, you know, God told me I could take your wife, and they would hand her over like nothing. Can't believe that. Yeah.
Oh, that was Jeff, one of my cult tour guides of sorts, that was so cool and gracious and frankly a blast to hang out with. A local in the town that knows where the hypothetical bodies are buried. But maybe not as hypothetical as I thought, but we shall see. Looking at this plot of land or this cult compound, you wouldn't even give it the time to care other than, oh wow, these people live in the middle of nowhere. There's trailers, desert dust blowing in the wind, tumbleweeds, and an eerie past that's trying to come back to life. But that was a past built on promise and industrialism, gold mining, and, well, bootlegging too, but hey, it was the times. But this past was nothing like the growing cult's very recent, current, alarming history playing out in their backyards. In fact, it was echoing a Waco vibe, Jonestown, Heaven's Gate-esque tale that the end was near. They just had to get there. But how? Well, locals were growing concerned. Followers as young as preteens were looking forward to the end of days. Possibly, even willing to take their own lives. To get to the other side because a man who renamed himself Michael told them so. This is classic cult. Isolation. And you'll hear soon the controlling of members' sex lives and partners and diets and contact with the outside. Fear-mongering and presenting a utopian that only they could attain with him. The concerned locals were tipped off because many members of the cult worked in the community surrounding their trailer compound, doing construction for the men or housekeeping for the women, and rumblings and fear of mass suicide started to resonate. But it wasn't until Michael, like I said, formerly known as Wayne Bent, allowed a camera crew from National Geographic into his space with the confidence of a fool that the world, although still extremely unknown this cold, would not only raise eyebrows, but he didn't think that this would alarm authorities, the FBI, that this was a disaster waiting to happen. He let cameras in and tried to straight face bullshit lie in the worst way, but it's the worst improv you've ever seen. The absolute worst. And there is a clip I need you to watch that I'm going to air the audio, but you need to find it online. I will link it in the show notes. You have to see him acting out this sexual thing that God wanted him to do. It's mind-bogglingly stupid.
14 inches of rain on Johnson Mesa, just like 10 miles above town, and it, like, in a couple hours, and it just a flash flood came and wiped him out in the middle of the night. But I think there was like 1,500 people that lived there at the time, and they had a giant hotel like the Broadmoor. It was going to be the county seat, and then that happened, you know, and it just never really recovered. The land kind of reverted back to big ranches and stuff because it was farming. A lot of the area was just how it was settled, but, you know, that didn't work out very well. So,
like, yeah, you didn't go quite far enough. It was like right next to his, to where the main guy lived, right next to his house.
You know, a lot of the families probably had their places here for 100 years or more.
Part of the ranch that they bought, I think it's like 2,000 acre ranch that they bought up there.
Well, I mean, this town is spooky. So you see, like, across the street, I don't know if you can see it, but it's on the hillside. There's a giant sandstone boulder, and it has a big white eagle painted on it. So it'd be just to the left of that blue house. So, like, in the 1930s, there was, during the Depression, people would ride the train. They would ride the train, you know, hoboing it and stuff. And I guess they got off there to camp for the night and built a fire under that rock. It was like an overhang. And the rock ended up cracking because of the heat, and it broke a giant slab off and crushed them. And they're still underneath it, and that's why that eagle's painted up there on the deal. So, yes, Folsom's pretty spooky at night, really. And then, like, the flood came through and killed 17 people, and, you know, all the shootouts. I think they shot a sheriff in my yard at the hotel. And it's just a lot of crazy stuff. And then, you know, people have been here for 10,000 years, you know, with the Folsom site.
Yeah, he's just kind of just an old man with long furry hair. I mean, he wasn't no John Travolta or nothing.
Exactly.
I mean,
there
was nothing to look up to as far as I was concerned.
I just don't get it.
I don't know. He must have had a hell of a story. I mean, a real good story that they fell for it all. It's all a bunch of BS as far as I was concerned. But anyway, so I went over to the Muskister, dug some holes for him with my auger, and unloaded some hay, some round bales. I think they were rolling the hay over what they just got done planting is what they were doing with it.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I got to... Well, then I just kind of knew some of them, and I hired a couple of guys to come and... I'd bought a ranch out there east of Des Moines and had them come and wire a couple of barns for me.
Okay.
And then,
so they did electrical work.
Yeah.
So
oh, yeah. No. Each one of them had a trade of some sort. They all did. They all had their own little kind of trade, and I think they just give them... I don't know for sure. I think they'd give their money back to him, a certain percentage of it.
Originally, I think the first Europeans that came through here was like the 1540s, when they were looking for Quivira, you know, the Seven Cities of Gold. An expedition came right through here, and in the journals they talk about where they camped, and, like, we have some artifacts from the conquistadors and stuff.
Wow.
And then the next time would be like Charles Goodnight with the cattle drives, you know, in the late 1860s. And then, you know, when the railroad came through, they established the town, and then it was a big shipping center for cattle and stuff. It had the largest shipping center west of Fort Worth, so just kind of a big ranching area. And then the flood happened and, you
wiped
know,
everything out.
Wiped it out. But then, you know, led to the find of, you know, the century, basically. So they found a paleo, an Indian arrowhead, in an extinct Ice Age bison's rib cage at a kill site. So it predated, you know, what they originally thought when man was here, like at 3,000 years, it dated it back to 10,000.
That last voice you heard on the montage was from Maddie of Folsom, New Mexico. A wonderful, generous guy that was willing to give us his time and his space, haunted hotel, to lead us through life in that small town and how he was connected to that cult. But he doesn't stop there. He also introduces us to his amazing friend, Jeff, who also has a connection to the cult. and frankly, was just a hoot and a half to hang out with. So we are super grateful to them. And also shout out to our friend Tom, who went on this wild journey with us from the beginning to the end. It's actually pretty crazy how we happened upon this story. So basically, for Father's Day in June, Greg, myself, and my father-in-law went to see this volcano in New Mexico. And then we drove past this town called Folsom, and it said there was a historical museum. And I was like, we got to go see that. And then I had Googled what the nearest other towns were, and Clayton happened to be one of the most haunted towns in New Mexico per a few websites. So anyways, we go to this museum after the volcano, and Maddie worked there. And Greg and him exchanged numbers, and he was telling him all about the history of the town. Whatever. We had planned to interview him about more history stuff. We had no idea about the cult at that point. So anyways, on July 4th, we are staying at this old cowboy hotel. It's just a fun July 4th thing in Cimarron, New Mexico. It's called the St. James Hotel. It is actually one of the coolest. It's so weird. The town reminds me of essentially the town I grew up in. Not Astoria. I went to high school in Warrenton, Oregon. But it's just a real nothing town. But then randomly there is this, it's luxurious for now. Yes, it's Victorian era furniture and stuff. But for the times, luxurious hotel in this middle of nowhere town where all the outlaws that you know about, the Jesse James, the Butch Cassidy, Billy Kid, whatever. There's still bullet holes in the ceiling of the restaurant and the bar. Crazy cool place. Really, really cool. So anyways, we were staying there for the 4th of July. And so was Maddie's mom, who we met, who worked at the, or owns the museum. But we didn't know that. So we're just randomly at the outdoor bar area, trying to wait our turn to play pool. And his mom is with her husband and they're ranchers. So they have a bunch of people that work for them, all these dudes that sleep in a bunkhouse, very Yellowstone. So her and I are talking and she asked me what I do for a living. And I said, I have a true crime podcast. We mostly cover religious leaders and cults, but I veer off occasionally. Anyways, she was like, oh my gosh, there was a cult in my hometown. And the FBI came knocking on my door because one of the young girls in the cult was their housekeeper. So that is how this all started. And so I started taking notes when she was talking. I got her phone number. I ended up contacting her son last week to interview first, just because he'd already done another podcast, so I knew he was comfortable. It's all just a side note, but it's pretty crazy how this all happened. Okay, back to the story. So this was all corroborated when we interviewed Maddie at the Folsom Museum just a couple days ago. And he was sleeping in the bunkhouse of their ranch when the FBI came knocking. And here is his version of it.
So I was, maybe 100 yards away in the bunkhouse from my parents' house. And I woke up one morning, it's my freshman year of college, I was back for the summer. And I look up there and I see a sheriff's car and then three black SUVs all in a line. So I was like, oh crap, what did I do? So I went up there, they're all agents in the yard and stuff, and just thought they're after me instead of that. But, it was a little bit, maybe a year later is probably when everything went down and they were, the FBI had been investigating it before. So they all clean house and do random jobs like that for people. And she was, my mom's house cleaner. And one day, while she was cleaning, she just kind of made a funny comment. And I think she said that, I'm not going to be there next week. So she's like, oh, what? Are you going on vacation? She's like, no, we're going to be gone. She's like, are you going to drink the Kool-Aid or what? So she was probably 17 when she started working for us. And this was after, the cult had gone away. And I think she kind of went on a hunger strike just to stay. Her parents actually left the place and she was, wanting to go back. So, but like I said, just really super nice girl, real sweet and stuff, but just naive.
It's not her fault. It's brainwashing.
And it was nice, that because she lived with us, when she helped us be like a nanny and stuff. So we slowly, you know, kind of acclimated her back to, like, reality.
And like a big fish in a small pond, they were starting to stand out. Except they weren't a big fish in the admirable way. No, no. They were a big, noticeable fish in a dry desert, trying to pretend like they were anything but the cult that they were. But their tactics for recruiting didn't go unnoticed. Jeff, the man I mentioned earlier, who before recording was like, oh no, I don't even know if I have that much to talk about with them. Like, whatever, I'll tell you, but like, I think I'll be boring. Gave me one of the more mind-blowing stories of recruitment that you're going to have to wait for in part two. Sorry, guys, that's not a very nice cliffhanger, but it's worth it. And it goes with the fish analogy that I just... Never mind. Okay, so I'm giving too much away. But besides the very personal bombshell story from Jeff, he had also just casually noticed something didn't seem right. Well, in a crowd where a cult member asked leading, inviting questions to a young kid in the pursuit of recruiting him. And Jeff isn't like a all-consuming true crime person like we are. In fact, I don't think he has ever even listened to a true crime podcast, watched a Dateline episode. He's a regular guy who owns a ranch, does welding into actually some of the most incredibly beautiful art, but he doesn't study up on this stuff like we do. Yet, his gut told him something just ain't right here. And here's Jeff talking about that.
But now the other guy, you know, I was talking about this, got that little shop on the side of the road. That was just weird to me. I just thought that was weird as hell.
Oh, yeah, you got to hear this story.
You know, so I'm in there trying to sell some, well, he's trying to sell it for me. I'm in there just negotiating what I want price-wise. And there's a kid comes in there. He's about 19 years old.
And this is like an ex-member or a current member? Then.
Well, yeah, I think he's just a current member. He just has a shop there and sells antiques and stuff. He's just like, you know, do you like to go hiking? You know. And the kid's like, yeah. And he's like, well, would you be interested in going hiking with us in Colorado sometime? And, you know, he's just a 19-year-old kid. I'm thinking to myself, this guy's recruiting him to the cult. That's just what I thought. I don't know whether that's true or not. It's hard to tell. I don't know. But it seemed kind of weird to me.
Yeah.
Somebody just walked in there. But apparently he knew the kid before and then just started talking to him about how he would want to go camping with him. I didn't know much. I knew he was from Clayton and his grandmother had recently died. Mm-hmm. I knew that through the conversation. I guess I was eavesdropping because I thought it was interesting the way he was talking to that kid.
Talking. If you had a gut instinct, you were probably right.
Yeah, even talking about books, what he was interested in reading, that sort of. So I was like, well, he's trying to. To me, it seemed like he was trying to get all his information from this kid to find out what he liked, so he could kind of lure him into something.
But before we get into the extremely disturbing building blocks of who this man is, let's talk about who he was, or who he says he was. Wayne Bent's early life seems like any cult leader's description of a damaged, abusive, and possibly 50% made up or exaggerated childhood. And listen, I'm not downplaying children's pain, but like Ash and Elena of Morbid have always said, and it's always stuck with me, feel bad for the child, but don't feel bad for the adult who committed these crimes. This is not word for word, but you get the point. But based on Wayne's pathological lying, I might throw him into the Charles Manson category of exaggerated, terrible childhood. Told to justify your terrible crimes. I only recently found out, per a Dateline podcast episode, that most of what I thought about Charlie Manson's childhood was not true. He was loved and taken in by family. Sure, it wasn't great, but he was a little shit that couldn't get it straight and wanted to control and manipulate people. And if I was a gambling man, I'd guess that Wayne's story is a little manipulated as well. But let's tell his backstory in the only reported way it has been. From the false prophet himself. Wayne Bent, later to be known because he changed his own name to Michael Treveser. Oddly, which I had a light bulb moment during speaking to Maddie, whom I mentioned earlier, when he was just describing like parts of the area of Folsom, New Mexico, and he casually mentioned a canyon of that same last name in the area. And I was like, did he change his last name? Like in the same way, if I was in a rush and I saw a duck and I was like, my new name is no longer Rachel O'Brien, it's Messiah Duck. That's what it is. Who knows? But it was weird to hear Maddie say it. I was like, is that how he came up with his fake name? Whatever. Who knows? But Wayne Bent would eventually be more publicly known as Michael Treveser. Wayne Bent was born May 18th, 1941. And from his account, he had a terrible childhood. He said his mother was killed and that he was sexually assaulted by a homosexual, an incident he used to preach how bad homosexuality was. I hate that I even have to say that sentence, but let me state, number one, if he was sexually assaulted as a child, my heart breaks for him, and I wish he would have had the love and therapy and positive reinforcement and a safe place to help heal that awful wound. But number two, all sexual assault is awful, terrible, sad, traumatizing, but sexual abuse and assault has nothing to do with someone being a homosexual. Being LGBTQ+ is just that. Having a preference like anyone else does. Blaming child abuse on a minority group is so decades ago. Get a life, Michael. Actually, Wayne. Let's go with Wayne. But regardless of if either of those incidents are true, his mother's death and the sexual abuse he suffered, I still hate that that may have happened to him. But now, skip forward to his first taste of religious royalty, the admiration of being a leader. His first parlay into being a religious leader was as a Seventh-day Adventist pastor, but he suddenly left in 1987, claiming that the denomination was one of the, quote, daughters of the great harlot, condemned in the book of Revelation. And during his time gigging as a Seventh-day Adventist preacher, he was married twice, but he spins the end of the marriages as that he was abandoned by two wives. So after gigging as a Seventh-day Adventist preacher, but, you know, falls out of good graces with them, but also claims that he had to tell the worst of their worst crimes and tell the world of all of humanity's evil, likely besides him, of course, he was on his new path.
One day, by myself, I was in my trailer, and I sat down in my chair just relaxing, and there was nothing on my mind in particular. And then God said to me, you are Messiah. Certainly by no instruction from me, two witnesses, these two, left their homes, left their families, And it wasn't at my instruction or behest. It just occurred.
It was a battle between me and God. And it's like Michael was on my side. He said, if you're angry at God, go tell him.
These women and their husbands became devoted followers who go with him from his original Idaho post to the remote desert of northern New Mexico, where the gluttony of his sexual crimes begin to take seed. And no one was off limits, including his own son. The new Messiah, anointed by himself, of course, treated his son like a peasant, like a person who was just so lucky to be in his presence. Not only did his son not call him dad in any of the footage I've seen. But he also breaks my heart to a severe degree because he acts so grateful that his dad will even look at him, let alone breathe the same air. And he does everything in his power to justify the pain of his own father sleeping with his wife. In the name of God. Yes, you heard me right. He justifies that it's okay, even though he's crying in these clips, that his dad had to sleep with his wife. But the visual of this next clip I will show you is one you must see. And this man deserves sympathy and understanding because what his father did to him is unfathomable.
God came down on Michael and forced him to consummate with Christiana. I mean, it was a terrible, strange act of God. I was astonished, and so was Michael.
I was forced down on the floor, and I had to get down. I was down just about like this. And I was in pain, and all I could do was groan. All I could do was kind of rock. And I started seeing that the consummation with Christiana was imminent, and I was going to be, I was going to have to do that.
That's it for this week of Seven Deadly Sinners. And you know, even if I don't meet this man face to face, I gotta go back. Try to speak to the members still in his grasp. But most of all, share with you how this story sort of ends. And he probably loves that it's a rabbit hole we can't navigate. But I'll do my best. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please keep leaving 5-star reviews and positive comments. I love you so much. This is a crazy story. Thanks for staying on board. Bye.